All right, hello everybody. This is Ken Reed. I hear there's a need for career deals, and so this is mine. It didn't come in the usual way. I don't advise anybody to do it the way I did it, because it's pretty risky. But this is what happened. I was born in Ohio, and I came to Connecticut when I was about 3 years old. I was born blind. And I went to kindergarten in a school they called Oak Hill School. It was a Connecticut School for the Blind then, and it later changed its name to Oak Hill School. And I was there until I was about, maybe 15. It wasn't easy. I was the only, there were only two black kids in the school, me and the girl named Antoinette Harvey, who's doing very well. I should add, doing very well. She's a teacher. And she was really smart. I mean, she skipped five or six grades and stuff, you know. Me, I'm just chugging along, so I'm just chugging along in school, and I did like music. I did take piano lessons, and when the high school trumpet player quit, I took over, and that was a natural instrument for me. But I liked science, and I had a nodding acquaintance with math. I did like science, and I hoped someday I would be a scientist. That didn't happen. When my family moved to Springfield, Mass, I tried to get into Springfield Tech. Because I was interested in electronics at the time. I was in high school. They wouldn't have it. So then I tried to get my brother who lived in Hartford. I tried to live with him, because if I could live with him, I could finish at Connecticut. They said, no, you can't do that. Perkins was the place to go, so I had to go to Perkins, which I didn't like very well. I didn't have very much freedom there. And I took piano tuning at Perkins, which I really didn't feel that I was going to do very well in. I thought I was doing okay in it, but the teacher didn't think so. So, who can you argue with? So I bounced out of Perkins without graduating. Perkins, and wound up a little while later working at places like Goodwill. And I said, this has got to stop. I was there about 3 years, and I said, this has got to stop. So one day I had enough, and I found there was a secretary who was the wife of one of my bosses, and a girlfriend with my boss. I don't know what the connection was between her and the boss, actually, but anyway, took a day off and went to a Standard Photo and got an application form. She helped me fill it out, and I turned it in. And in about 2 weeks, they said, come on, we'll be glad to have you. So I worked there for about 3 years. This takes me up to about 21 now. 22. And I was 21. I started. I was married. Had a little boy. And I stayed there until they messed around with me. they got these new machines. We were working on these Peco dip and dunk machines, they called them. Stand on your feet and hang the film and watch it go into the tank and watch it change tanks and stuff like that. Then they got splicing machines, and they were doing the stuff on the reels now, on the reels then. And they wanted to cut our pay because they said we could be more efficient. Well, we were turning out way more work than we were before. And I didn't think it was quite fair that they, you know, they cut my pay. So I said, well, this isn't right. If you don't change by April 1st, I am leaving. Of course, they didn't do anything, so I left. I left there, and finally I was home, staying with my mother because me and my wife were getting divorced at the time, first wife. And so I stayed with my mother for a while. And it got to where I had to make a decision. So my mother said, well, why don't you go live with your sister in Washington, D.C.? And so I went, got on the bus or went to Washington, D.C. Actually, they came and picked me up. And then I made a decision. I said, either I am going to make it playing or I'm going to go to school. So what happened was I wound up doing both. I went there. I got my GED there. I hadn't got a gig playing yet, a regular gig playing yet, but I was just messing around there. Finally, I did get a gig playing there. There was a club, and a band leader noticed me, and he decided that he wanted to hire me. And the guy who first attracted me was a guy named Buck Hill. He's a tenor player, and I said, I have got to get in this band some way or other. So he was playing at this club called the Top of the Foolery, and I was down there sitting in jamming. And he got along, you know, me and him got along fine. So, and Marshall Hawkins, the band leader, said, "Okay, come on, you're in the group." So I was glad about that. But you know, I still had to finish my stuff here. So I got a GED, and I still messing around DuPont's. There was a place called DuPont Circle where a lot of people mess around and talk and get into discussions about this and that and talk about politics and, you know, all that. And as I was leaving, I ran into this guy who worked at the Labor Department, and he said, I noticed that he was from Massachusetts. He sounded like he might be from Fall River. I said, are you from Fall River? He said, yeah, I'm from Fall River. How did you know? I said, I could tell by your accent. And he said, well, there's a program, Manpower Administration has a program. We might be able to get you in. And so finally that came through, and I wound up working at the Labor Department as a clerk typist. I was there about 3.5 years. So, of course, that wasn't the ideal job, but it kept me going. I didn't starve to death. I was able to get my own apartment away from my sister and live by myself and stuff like that. Until they decided to move away from the Rhode Island Avenue address where I had started with them. They moved to a building called the Patrick Henry Building, which was not convenient for me to get to in the morning, because I could walk to the Rhode Island Avenue place, but it wasn't convenient, and plus my boss had been promoted, and he left me in the care of other people who didn't really know what the heck they were doing, and so I found it quite uncomfortable to be there anymore. So I said, okay, this is going to have to stop here again. And so I went to The Federation. The Federation was encouraging people like me to who were underemployed to get their stuff together. So what happened was I applied to go to Catholic University, and they, after some hemming and hawing, accepted me. I tried Howard University, and they wouldn't accept me because they said, "Well, he's blind; he might fall down the stairs. We don't want to take it. We don't want to take responsibility for that." Those silly people. At any rate, you know, that would have been my first choice to go to Howard, but you know. I went to Catholic University, and the dean sort of talked me into it. He said, they put me on probation. You got to take these courses and these courses, and if you pass these courses, we'll accept you into the engineering department. So I passed those courses. And, you know, it wasn't like, I have to give credit to my reader, who I later married, helped a great deal. And I probably couldn't have done it without her. I'll tell you right now. With all recording for the blind helped a great deal also, because I was able to get my stuff on tape. You know, but you can't always get the stuff, the books that they recommend. But I was able to, between the recording for the blind and my reader, and a lot of patience, was able to cope with the courses. Almost quit because electromagnetism, E&M, they call it. It is a course designed to wash people out, and it almost washed me out, but I was able to make it. It took me 7 years to finish Catholic University. But in 1980, I graduated from there. Okay, in 1980, I graduated from there. And then it was time to find a job somewhere. Well, I got an interview from DEC. Would have been glad to work there because I liked computers and stuff. But they said, a bite from NASA, and they said, "We'll let NASA hire him." So that was not a bad place to work. I'm an old space cadet, so I said, "Okay, you know, NASA's a cool place to work." So I wound up working at NASA. The guy who interviewed me, wasn't the guy I was working for, which I thought was a letdown. The guy who my boss didn't really know how to deal with a blind person. He just didn't know. And for a whole year, I just boned up on, you know, learning how to get around the VACs that we had there, and work with a few other people down the hall who were doing other things with computers, mainly image processing and stuff, which I found interesting, but that wasn't really my niche, but I was able to do something with them, keep me busy. And so then the guy who I interviewed, he left. The guy who I interviewed came on as my boss, and the other guy, my boss, left to do something. I guess he retired. Yeah, that's what he did. So I was back with the guy who interviewed me, and we did a lot of stuff. We did a lot of strange stuff. We were testing things like chips that we made in-house. The place that I was, you know, down in the other wing, they have a semiconductor lab, and they make semiconductors. They make detectors, and these detectors have to be tested. So we were testing these detectors with the software that I was writing. A guy named John Wolfgang wrote a program called PTL, which was the program that we used to test these chips. It drove some electronics on the outside of the computer, similar to a fancy sound card, I guess if you could say it that way. Had a lot of DACs and a lot of A to D converters and things that we could use to test and evaluate the results of these tests. And we did that for a while, and then we got into the PIL project. So, which was an electronic pill. It had a battery that was rechargeable. We made a recharging station for it. And as you swallow the pill, there was a crystal inside the pill that was temperature sensitive, which mainly they're not. Mainly they're fixed temperatures, but we found a company who made a crystal that was temperature sensitive, and we could read the frequency of this pill and into a receiver, which I had the responsibility for designing. And in the receiver, we would read out the temperature of this person who swallowed the pill. And it would take about 72 hours to pass this pill all the way through his system and come out the other end, which we didn't retrieve. We were talking about retrieving them, but we didn't have to retrieve them because the company who made them after later on found a way to make them cheap enough that they didn't have to be retrieved. So, you know, different things like that. But later on, that boss left, and I was sort of, the place kind of went, a new guy came in. He hired a whole bunch of people, because by the time Don had left, there was only like 3 people in our section. When Pete got there, a whole bunch of people came in, and they started doing all this CCD work. I had me and another woman who worked there, Audrey, we made a CCD driver, which I had no way of knowing how a CCD driver was supposed to be made. I had to walk the floor for about 2 weeks, and I figured out how I was supposed to do it because nobody told me how to do it. We just had to find out how to do it. And I said, I came up with a concept, and the one thing that helped me in my concept, believe it or not, was the CMOS cookbook. Because in the CMOS cookbook, it has a really cool hint about how to do things, about how I want to do things. And I created a programmable device without calling it a programmable device, but it was programmable. So that was the first, I guess, time they had ever done it that way, because usually they had a hardwired device. Ours needed to be programmable because we didn't know how the designer wanted to do things. So that was one of the criteria. At any rate, it worked, and finally, but it took a lot of chips to do it. It took, I don't know, a lot of chips. Okay, so anyway, AMD finally came up with a gadget that we could use that would eliminate very many chips that we were using before, and it's a programmable device, so we used that device. So anyway, most of our lab today uses that device. They don't give me any credit for it, but that's a different story. So anyway, I was there, and finally, after they got so visual, I got involved more in administrative things, like being on panels and things like that, or getting into the advisory committees for this and that. And So I stayed there. I was working at NASA for 22 years, waiting for eligibility to retire, which I did retire. And I also did some music on the way. You know, did some recording for a company called Maple Shade, and I did a recording with Clifford Jordan, who was a big hero of mine. That was really cool. I did some. We never did record. Well, we recorded with him, but it never came out. I wish it had. It was a great recording. But I made one of my own because I got tired of waiting for people, so I just made a recording of my own and put it out. And they said, tell me it got to Japan, so that's an accomplishment. I finally, after I retired, I left Maryland, left NASA, and came back to Connecticut, and I'm here. Here in Enfield, Connecticut, which is about 12 miles from Hartford, and I got my cousins are here, my nieces and nephews are here, my brother is here, my sister lives in Springfield, so it's close to everything, you know. And I remarried my look at that, brother's sister-in-law, so we have the same cousins, we have the same nieces and the nephews, so it's kind of strange. But anyway, my brother's wife's sister, I mean my brother's wife's sister, that's how it works, and her name is Cheryl. And so I still play around town. I'm playing trumpet and flugelhorn with a baritone saxophone player. And we have a really good guitarist. His name is Doug Mayer. You'll hear about him someday. And our bass player is a nationally renowned bass player. And I guess that's all I could tell you. That's the whole story. I'd also like to thank Larry for giving us a platform for these kind of things, because I've heard others and they're very good. And something that we all need to do. Confession's good for the soul. Bye-bye.